It is 7:30, time once again for Community Forum, and we're very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, Jen Marlowe. Jen Marlowe is co-director and co-producer of the film Darfur Diaries, Message from Home, and she's also co-author of the book Darfur Diaries, Stories of Survival. Jen, thank you very much for coming in and sharing time with us this morning.
Thanks for having me here.
Let's begin. Tell us, how is it that you got involved with producing this film, Darfur Diaries?
My involvement was actually the last between me and my colleagues. The project really started when my colleague Aisha Bain was doing an internship for the Center for the Prevention of Genocide in Washington, D.C. And this was in the fall of 2003. And she was investigating reports and claims that she'd heard that there was something going on in Darfur, in this western region of Sudan, and there was absolutely nothing in the mainstream media about this. She was doing the investigation. She was calling Darfurians that she got connected to that were in D.C. They were giving her numbers of relatives and friends that they had back home in Darfur who were refugees in Chad, and she began to piece together a picture of really unbelievable atrocities. And then when she would go home at night and open up the newspaper or turn on the news and see absolutely nothing there that reflected what she was uncovering at work, this disturbed her greatly. So she started out, through the Center for the Prevention of Genocide, launching a media advocacy campaign to really try to push the mainstream media outlets to tell the story, to cover the story. So she was calling newspapers, magazines, print media, radio, TV, every kind of media, and she was repeatedly told no. She was told it's not important enough to cover, or if it were important, it would already be being covered, so as long as the network next door isn't covering it, then they don't have to cover it. Unbelievably, one place told her that the reason they couldn't do a story about Darfur is because they recently ran a piece about Uganda. She was growing increasingly upset and frustrated by that, and she was venting this frustration to my other colleague, Adam Shapiro. And Adam had just gotten back from Iraq, where he had worked on his first filming project, a film called About Baghdad. And he was really wrapping his brain around this idea of how film can be used as a tool of activism, how it can go beyond education, really, and try to inspire people to take action and to create change. And so he suggested to them that the two of them go out there, that they could raise the money, that they could buy the equipment, and that if other people weren't doing their responsibility to tell the story, that really it was incumbent on them to go out there and do it. So they, Aisha agreed. They started making their plans, and it was at this time that I had lunch with Adam. It was in May 2004, and I say that date specifically because when Adam told me about what he and Aisha were planning on doing, I had never heard of Darfur until that moment. I had never even heard the word Darfur. I knew about Sudan a little bit. I knew there had been a decades-long civil war between the north and the south of the country, but I'd never heard of Darfur, and that date is significant because that was right in the middle of the 100 days of the 10-year anniversary of the genocide in Rwanda. Between, you know, April and June 1994 was the genocide in Rwanda. So in 2004, May 2004, there was a lot of coverage of that 10-year anniversary. And I could turn on BBC or CNN and I could see dignitaries from different countries and from the UN talking in ceremonies and making a lot of speeches that sounded very sincere about the lessons the world had learned from Rwanda and how, if the world was confronted again with a situation similar to Rwanda, that this time the response would be different. And no one was mentioning in any of those speeches what was happening right at that moment in Darfur. The villages being burned down, the refugees being driven across the border, the mass murder of civilians, mass rape of women and girls. So very soon after I had that lunch with Adam and he alerted me to that there was a crisis in Darfur and what he and Aisha were hoping to do about it, I wrote him an email saying, are you looking for a third person on your team? Because it's incredibly important that this story be told.
Can you give us a kind of a brief history of how the situation in Darfur came about?
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to, actually, because very much, I think it's misconstrued in the media that we get. First of all, the media says that often will say that the conflict started in February 2003 when the Sudan Liberation Army, which is one of the main rebel groups, first took up arms against the government. And the media will also tell us that it's that the conflict is essentially Arabs versus Africans. And both those things are really untrue. The Arab versus African paradigm to look at the conflict, at best, that's a gross oversimplification. And at worst, it's really quite a damaging and destructive, a destructive inaccuracy. The conflict is not at its core an ethnic conflict. Yes, there is an ethnic component to what's going on. That is undeniable. But, I mean, one of the reasons why you can't call it an Arab versus African conflict is because those terms historically are not meaningful in Sudan. Ethnicity in Sudan in general and in Darfur in particular is extremely fluid and extremely complex. Who is Arab and who is African? Sudan is the largest country in Africa. Everyone there is African. Arabic is the lingua franca of Sudan. Most people speak Arabic. If you try to gauge it by skin color and you have this idea in your mind, okay, well, Africans are probably darker skinned than Arabs. Well, that doesn't work in Darfur. You can't tell by looking at someone. Everyone is equally dark or equally not. There's someone in our film, a young boy who has light skin, green eyes. You might look at him and say, okay, so he must be from an Arab tribe. And then he's speaking Zagawa, his native tongue, which is one of the so-called African tribes. So it's extremely fluid and complex. There's been years and centuries, really, of intermarriage between the tribes. Often livelihood determined what ethnicity you identified with, and usually farming communities took on the African identity, and nomadic communities took on the Arab identity. However, if there was someone from a farming community that had a good crop that year, bought a few camels, they might go and graze those camels with the nomadic tribe and become absorbed in that tribe. The whole idea of Arabization of Sudan. I mean, there's a lot of status that's associated with the Arab identity. So there's tribes like the Zagawa tribe, which is one of the tribes that is on the African side of that divide, as it's portrayed to us. Historically, was often considered an Arab tribe in other times in Sudan's history, and the same is true not just in Darfur but in other regions of Sudan. In the Nuba Mountains, where there's unrest and there's been unrest brewing, the Nubians had been considered Arab for a long time, and are recently now in the last couple years sort of asserting their African identity. So it's very fluid and complex. You certainly can't use religion as a determining factor, because in Darfur everyone is Muslim. Religion was certainly used as a way to describe the North-South Civil War. It was often characterized as a religious war of Muslims versus Christians and animists, and then that didn't work to try to use that simplification in Darfur, although actually reporters initially did characterize it as Muslims versus Christians and Africans, and then those reporters later learned that Darfur is all Muslim, and that characterization didn't work, so then they began using the Arab versus African characterization. So then the question of, if it's not an ethnic conflict at core, what is it? And that goes to the second point about the media saying that the SLA started the conflict in 2003 when they first took up arms against the Sudanese government. February 2003 was certainly a time of escalation of the conflict. That was probably the first major successful attack that the SLA launched against a government police station. But the SLA was responding to decades and decades of marginalization and oppression, and over the years, increasing violence at the hands of the government and at the hands of their proxy militia, which are known as the Janjaweed. So the problems in Darfur did not begin in 2003. The crisis escalated then, but it really has its history, and it's really rooted in an extremely brutal, oppressive central government that keeps the rest of the country, that is not from the very small number of elite and privileged tribes that their power is drawn from. They keep the rest of the country essentially marginalized and oppressed, without equal resources, without equal access. And rebellion started in Darfur as a way to respond to this, as a way to try to demand equal rights and equal access.
So is similar problems like this happening in the rest of the country as well?
Absolutely, yes. As I mentioned, there had been a decades-long civil war between the north and the south of the country, some of the very same issues that the Southern Rebel Movement, which is the SPLA, the Sudan People's Liberation Army, or SPLM, movement instead of army, it's interchangeable, they were fighting for some of this exact same rights and exact same issues that's now going on in Darfur. There's been rebellions in the east of the country, in Port Sudan, amongst the Beja population, and there was recently an agreement signed between the Beja rebels and the government, and whether it will stick and whether it will hold remains to be seen. And again, like I said, there's been unrest and rebellions brewing in the Nuba Mountains. Most of the citizens of Sudan do not feel that this government represents them or has their needs or their concerns at all on the agenda.
All right, so talk about what is currently happening in Darfur.
The situation in Darfur right now is, abysmal is really the only word to describe it. It's horrific, and it's getting worse. There is nearly on a daily basis attacks against civilians that are being perpetrated, if not by the government directly with government troops and government bomber planes and helicopter gunships, then by the Janjaweed militia, which seems to have been reconstituted by the government, rearmed and remotivated to go and attack. And people in Darfur are facing this now on a daily basis. And the attacks are getting more brutal, more aggressive. And people who had formerly at least had their physical security somewhat secured, people who were in the internally displaced people camps, at least there hadn't been attacks directly on them while they were inside the camps. That's beginning to change. Perhaps most alarmingly, the violence is now, in a very real way, beginning to spread into Chad. And in eastern Chad, there's about 250,000 Darfurian refugees in refugee camps. So they're now no longer secure, and neither are local Chadians. And more recently, it's begun to spread into the Central African Republic. So the threat of this becoming a regional disaster of proportions that are almost unimaginable, it's a very, very real threat right now.
So Chad being the country to the immediate west of Sudan?
Yes, exactly.
All right. And so this means that the Sudan government forces are moving into Chad and attacking these people?
Certainly the Janjaweed militias are, and these are proxy militias for the government. And there have been eyewitnesses on certain attacks that said that the Janjaweed had been acting under government cover, and that there's been government cover in the form of Antonov planes, airplanes, which are the bomber planes of choice by the Sudanese government, and of helicopter gunships. So it's very, very clear to every eyewitness that we talk to that these attacks between the Janjaweed from the Janjaweed are highly in a high level of coordination with the army and with the government.
So you physically went to Chad, is that correct? Your film.
Yes. Well, we started in Chad, our journey. We flew into N'Djamena, which is the capital of Chad, with the help of the UNHCR, which is the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. We made our way towards eastern Chad, to the border area where the refugee camps are. We spent time in the refugee camps talking to refugees, and then we crossed over the border into North Darfur. And we spent some time there going to villages which have been destroyed, but where there are still displaced people in the area, talking to civilians, talking to community leaders, talking to sheikhs or omdas, which were the leaders of the villages, and also talking to some of the leaders of the Sudan Liberation Movement, which is one of the lead rebel groups. We didn't have a visa from the Sudanese government to do this. They don't give visas to independent journalists who are trying to document the atrocities they're perpetrating. They actually, it's very hard to even get a visa if you're from a very well-known media outlet. So we had to sneak across the border, and then we had to stay behind rebel lines and stay in the rebel-controlled areas.
Tell me what you learned from doing your work. You had experience doing interviews with people in conflict zones before. Was this similar to that?
Yeah, my one of the things that really compelled me to using film as a medium for doing my work was exactly what you mentioned. I had done video dialogue work with youth in conflict zones. So that would be me taking a camera. For example, when I was living in Israel and in Palestine, I might take the video camera, go to Gaza, and work with a group of young people there who wanted to give a message to their Israeli colleagues. And I would work with them and film what they wanted to either tell their colleagues or using the camera to show what they wanted to show their colleagues. Then I might take that to Tel Aviv, show it to a group of Israeli youth, and then they might film a response, and then I'd bring that response to Janine and so on and so forth. So that was really, it was through that project that I began to understand the incredible power of film and video as a tool of communication. So that absolutely informed the work that I did in Chad and Darfur. In terms of what I learned, I learned and continue to learn reams and every day from this project. I feel like I've been on a sort of a three-prong simultaneous crash course PhD program or something. But in doing the interviews and conducting the interviews in Chad and Darfur, I think what stood out for me was the incredible resilience and dignity of the people that we met, that people were so welcoming of us, wanted us to be there, wanted to tell us their stories. In some ways, it felt like the cameras were, you know, people understood that the cameras were there because we were trying to bring their stories to the world, and they wanted that to happen, and they appreciated that. But even more powerful than that was the fact that we were there. And even without the cameras, I think the feeling of sitting down, looking into someone's eyes, sitting face to face, and them knowing that there was someone there bearing witness to what they had gone through was such a powerful thing. I was expected to confront the atrocities. I was expecting to hear horrible things. I wasn't expecting for people's strength and courage and humanity to show through. I wasn't expecting that I would spend time laughing with people and singing songs with the Darfurians that we met. There is an incredible resilience, an incredible insistence on living life was really inspiring. I mean, when I think back on the trip, yes, we saw and heard unspeakably horrible things, but in some ways the feelings of hope and inspiration because of people's strength and courage and resilience is even stronger for me.
And is that reflected in the film?
I think it really is. And people have commented, wow, people are so strong. And I mean, in some cases, people are very stoic when they're telling their stories. That's a sign of resilience. It's also a sign of being traumatized. But I think absolutely people's integrity and dignity show through. And that was really one of our goals, because very often if you are going to see coverage about a crisis in Africa, first of all, it's very, and taking Darfur as a prime example, the media is covering Darfur a lot now. They're doing a lot better job than they were at the time that we made the plans to go out there, because the story wasn't being told at all. But very often, you're only hearing Western voices talk about Darfurians. You're hearing experts from the UN or from the aid organizations or Western analysts talking about Darfur, rather than letting Darfurians speak by themselves and for ourselves. And that's really what the heart of our film is providing a platform for Darfurians to talk and speak about their experiences themselves. And also, if you are going to see images of crisis, usually you just see people only as victims, like victims with a capital V or refugees with a capital R. Like, that is their whole identity. You see, streams and columns of miserable refugees. You see the suffering, but you don't see the humanity. And that becomes its own form of dehumanization. So I think it's very important that in our film there's moments where people laugh, because when you can see someone on the screen and they remind you of your little brother or they remind you of your grandmother, then you're connecting with them as one human being to another. And it's only then that you can fully appreciate that that person's life is every bit as valuable as your life and every bit as important as your life.
On your website, darfurdiaries.org, you have a really nice review by Alice Walker, a famous author, saying that she walked away from the film with her hopes renewed.
Yeah, she said, because I know the quote, she left the film and the book feeling a great deal more hope for us all. And I think in that quote, it's a strange quote in a way, because we're not describing a hopeful situation. But I think when Alice Walker read the book and saw the film, which we were extremely pleased and thrilled that she had agreed to do, I think exactly what I was talking about is what spoke to her, the incredible dignity and integrity of the people. And I think that is what gave her hope, that people who have been so horribly brutalized still were counting it among their absolute top priority to educate their children, and that there were refugees in the refugee camps in Chad who they couldn't wait until the UN was ready to start schools. Education for their children was too urgent. They started their own schools. They registered themselves as teachers. They, you know, discovered who had been teachers in Darfur, registered their kids, sat them down on the sand under the blazing sun with absolutely nothing, and began to teach their kids. I think it's that kind of resiliency that I think that was what Alice Walker was referring to.
And in fact, connected to the work you're doing, you guys are working on an education project, is that correct?
Absolutely. It was very important to us that the film and the book provide some kind of direct benefit back to the communities where we were. Hopefully there's the long-term benefit of advocating on their behalf and inspiring activism and telling their stories, but we wanted to do something also more concrete. So we launched an initiative to try to rebuild schools or reestablish schools in the destroyed villages where we visited, because for exactly the reason that I just mentioned, what we heard over and over again, and this was both from the refugees that had made it into Chad and the displaced people that we talked to into Darfur, education for themselves and for their children was the highest priority. I mean, equal to their need for food and security and shelter, they placed education at just as high a value. So it seemed very natural for us to try to support their efforts to make sure that that their kids were getting some kind of education.
Talk a little bit about the bigger picture solutions that are being presented and what you see as viable options. I just saw on C-SPAN a couple days ago a group involved with Darfur calling for more UN forces in there, that is the solution. Do you see a military option here as a solution, or do you see something that needs to be done on the political level?
There's been a lot of emphasis and talk about getting UN troops on the ground, and the UN Security Council did pass a resolution in August stating that they approved a UN force. Right now, it's sort of a misrepresentation to say getting more UN troops on the ground, because right now there aren't any UN troops. It's actually, there's an African Union force on the ground right now. But they're not really a peacekeeping operation. The African Union troops were sent as observers of a ceasefire, and they're supposed to be monitors of a ceasefire that has been the ceasefire has been in shambles for 2 years now. But their mandate does not include protection of civilians, and they're only 7,000 troops strong. And Darfur is it's been said that it's the size of Texas or France. So the African Union troops that are there are absolutely under trooped, if you can say that. I mean, undermanned. Their logistics, their finances, all of that is absolutely inadequate, and their mandate doesn't even give them the right to protect civilians. So I understand all the calls for wanting to have a more robust force on the ground that is really there to protect civilians. Security and protection for people is absolutely the first priority. But unless it's done as part of a political process, it's just not going to help. I mean, you can argue all you like that the moral imperative is there to send a UN force on the ground without the consent of the Sudanese government. The Sudanese government are the perpetrators. They're the ones doing this to their civilian population. Morally speaking, sure, you can argue that you shouldn't need their consent for their people to receive protection, because they are the ones harming them. But practically speaking, throwing troops at a chaotic situation the way it is now, with it happening against the will of the Sudanese government, would only intensify the conflict. It would only lead to many more losses of civilian lives. That's what would happen. It would be throwing troops into a quagmire. They're the only way for an intervention force, or the only way for a peacekeeping force to be effective, is if there's actually a peace process happening. And there are beginning to be finally, after many months of stalemate, basically, there's beginning to be a re-energizing of the political process. That definitely gives me some hope. It also makes me worried. I think part of the reason that the government is ramping up their actions now is to try to change the situation on the ground ahead of going into a new round of peace talks. And that's a pattern that they've employed in the past, when right before or right during when talks are beginning, they want to create a situation on the ground that puts them at an advantage. So that's certainly one of the reasons why, I think, one of the reasons why the past couple weeks have been so bloody.
So what would you encourage people to do to help in this situation?
There's a lot of different ways to help, and there's a lot of different ways to be involved. Obviously, there's a great humanitarian disastrous aspect of this, and humanitarian help is needed, and the humanitarian organizations that are there need to be supported. But focusing only on humanitarian aid in some ways is trying to, you know, to there's not a humanitarian band-aid that's going to solve the political crisis that's underlying the humanitarian crisis. I think here in this country, it's very important that we continue to push our government and our media at all different levels to be involved for the long term, and to be involved and engaged constructively. There is no quick fix to the situation, and I think that our government spent years and years doing absolutely nothing. They came out early on. They, you know, Colin Powell called it a genocide. You know, Congress and then Colin Powell in the summer or fall 2004, that was a bold move for the U.S. government, but it was just words, and they followed up doing absolutely nothing for a very long time, until the grassroots pressure from citizens of this country grew to a point that it pressed the U.S. government into starting to take more meaningful action. Unfortunately, that action has been done in a way that I call almost cowboy diplomacy, where the U.S. has tried to, you know, send someone to the negotiations that were happening and strong arm through an agreement. Well, so, you know, Robert Zoellick got sent to the final round of the negotiations that were currently happening in Abuja, Nigeria. This was this past May. And, you know, put the Darfur peace agreement on the table, gave the parties a couple days to look at it. It actually only got translated into Arabic a few days before they were told they had to sign it. So people were really not able to talk about, discuss, internalize all the aspects of the agreement, and then was told, okay, this is it. You know, the world is done with you. This is the agreement. Take it or leave it. Thinking that he could then muscle this agreement through. Well, the majority of people left it. The majority of the negotiators at that table thought that agreement wasn't sufficient, or didn't adequately address their concerns, and they didn't sign. The only two signatories on that agreement were the government of Sudan and the leader of one of the rebel factions. His name is Minni Minawi, and he is the most abusive of all the rebel leaders. And again, another mischaracterization of the media. The media often, you know, would say Minni Minawi is the largest faction of the SLA. It wasn't the largest faction of the SLA. It's the faction that actually has the least popular support. The SLA has broken up into several factions, and the faction led by Minawi is thought to be least representative of the needs and desires of the people of Darfur. So this is the kind of diplomacy that the U.S. had been engaged in, and that doesn't work. So it's not enough that we press our government to be involved. I think we have to press them to be involved thoughtfully and constructively and for the long term. It's not just the national level where we can have an influence as well. There have been, on the state level, there has been state legislations. State senators have introduced legislations where their state will divest their pension plan from companies that do business with the government of Sudan. And State Senator Jackie Collins in Illinois was the first to do this. So Illinois was the first state whose pension plan divested from companies that do business with Sudan. And then many other states have followed since. Students at universities have gotten universities also to divest holdings from companies that do business with the government of Sudan. Harvard University, because of student activism there, was the first. They divested their holds in PetroChina, which is a Chinese oil company that does very lucrative business with the government of Sudan. The amazing thing about their success in that is that, you know, Harvard does not have a history of divestment. When it came to South Africa and apartheid, Harvard divested only partially and reluctantly and last. And that was when divestment was, you know, was kind of chic among universities especially. But Harvard students got Harvard to take the lead on this issue because of extremely well-organized and implemented activist campaign that they did. So I think there's a lot that we can do to get involved. There's a lot we can do to push our media, again, not just to cover this issue, but to cover it thoughtfully. It is so damaging, this polarization of Arab versus African that has been portrayed. I think it's great that, you know, MSNBC with Ann Curry has featured Darfur and had done a special spotlight, but they have been so guilty at perpetrating that Arab versus African paradigm. I think we need to respond to that and to push them to cover it more accurately and constructively.
Very good. Well, I want to thank you very much for coming in this morning.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on the show.
We've just been talking with Jen Marlowe. She is co-director and co-producer of the film Darfur Diaries, Message from Home, and co-author of the book Darfur Diaries, Stories of Survival. And if you miss any of those, you can go to their website at darfurdiaries.org.